Good afternoon. On behalf of Chancellor Blank, I'd like to apologize for her not being able to be here, but she is in Indianapolis today, and so I'm here in the Faculty Senate with you, which is nice because I love giving people awards or being at places where people are getting awards, and that's one of the things we'll be doing today. So I would first ask the faculty to rise as they're able for the reading of the memorial resolutions. At this point, I would like to recognize Professor Tom Sutula to present the memorial resolution for Professor Emeritus Ray Chung.
Raymond Chun, Professor Emeritus of Neurology and Pediatrics, died on March 14, 2014, at age 88. He was recruited by Dr. Francis Forster in 1958 and became professor in 1971. And was a world-renowned child neurologist whose contributions significantly influenced the practice and understanding of pediatric neurology. He invented the Chun gun, which was an ingenious device used to focus light and cooling and enabled the detection of brain fluid collections in infants before the age of modern imaging. His talents beyond neurology included mushroom harvesting and an outstanding tennis game that was sought after by the UW tennis team as a practice partner even in his retirement. He possessed kindness, grace, and an ability to see joy in every phase of life that enriched his patients and his colleagues.
Next, I'd like to recognize Professor Doug Soldot to present the memorial resolution for Professor Emeritus Jim Love.
Professor Emeritus James R. Love passed away on February 25th, 2014 in Madison, Wisconsin. He was 93 years old and is survived by Nancy, his wife of 63 years, his two sons John and Peter, and granddaughter Amanda. Jim was born on a farm outside of Rugby, North Dakota. He earned his bachelor's degree at North Dakota State in 1944. In 1951, he matriculated at the University of Wisconsin to earn his master's and PhD in soil science in 1956. He immediately joined the faculty, was promoted to associate professor in 1960, full professor in 1972. He retired in 1986. Jim was the face of soil science to countless undergraduates during his many years as the sole instructor of introductory soil science, where he skillfully conveyed the importance and beauty of soil while never cutting corners on the difficulty of the subject. Professor Love also founded the Turf and Ground Specialization at UW-Madison in 1961. He advised over 100 students and connected them to positions of responsibility in a grateful industry. His dedication to teaching and undergraduate advising set a standard in the college seldom attained. Dr. Love was widely loved and admired by his students. The strength of and industry support for the turf grass program at UW will be a lasting legacy of Professor Love.
Next, I'd like to recognize Professor Larry Mueller to present the memorial resolution for Professor Emeritus Tom Shomish.
Professor Emeritus Tom Shomish, age 70, passed away peacefully with his family by his side on Sunday, January 4th of this year here in Madison. Tom joined the Department of Agricultural Journalism, now the Department of Life Sciences Communication, in 1983. He taught advertising, market research, and marketing campaigns. Tom advised the National Agri-Marketing Association, Student Association, for 17 years. We're hoping for a national championship in basketball tonight. During Tom's tenure, his NAMA chapter was named national champions as a chapter 9 out of the 17 years. He was named Outstanding Student Advisor in 1996 and served as department chair from 1999 until his retirement in 2004. Good. As you might take from the photo, Tom was an avid golfer. He served on the advisory boards of both the University of Wisconsin, University Ridge Golf Course for many years, and also at Hawks Landing. He also served with distinction on the board of directors of the Group Health Cooperative, served there for 37 years, and finally captained a golf team made up of UW faculty men and women, and one dean. And they won several championships over the years, and I was a member of that team, and we'll miss him.
Today we will be honoring four faculty members who have been selected by the divisional executive committees to receive the Hilldale Award in recognition. Oh, you can stay standing the whole time if you'd like to honor the Hilldale recipients. I think that would be a particularly nice honor. In recognition of their distinguished careers in teaching, research, and service while members of the faculty here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. First, I would like to invite Jeff Beneker, Chair of the Department of Classics, to present Professor Rachel Fell-Hay Brenner's recipient of the Hilldale Award in Arts and Humanities.
Professor Rachel Brenner was nominated for the Hilldale Award with the unanimous endorsement of the Executive Committee of the Department of Classics, soon to become the Department of Classical and Ancient Near Eastern Studies, and with the enthusiastic support of Simone Schwaber, Director of the Center for Jewish Studies. Professor Brenner's contributions to the field of Hebrew literature and Holocaust studies are weighty, both in the literal and the figurative senses. She has published 6 books, some 70 articles in journals and edited volumes, and has many other publications besides. But she is not merely prolific. Professor Brenner's scholarship has exceptional breadth and variety, and she has had enormous impact. Her main focus of study, the fortitude of ethics in time of hardship and terror, is genuinely interdisciplinary, and throughout her career, Professor Brenner has probed ultimate ethical dilemmas as they emerge in literature, while asking hard and penetrating questions, such as, how did the Holocaust affect the worldview of Jews who watched the tragedy from afar? How did the experience shape the development of Israeli society, its relationship with its Arab citizens, and its attitude to the world? What do the diaries of the victims and the eyewitnesses of the Holocaust teach about the steadfastness of ethical principles in times of terror? Her research embraces several national literatures and extends from the North American continent to Europe and to Israel. Her influence has been widely recognized. Consider, for example, this comment from one prominent scholar in Holocaust studies. Her entire corpus, books, articles, and chapters, reveal a scholar who writes with grace and precision while treating the manifold literary, methodological, philosophical, and psychological issues which emerge in the wake of the Holocaust. Professor Brenner's research falls into 3 broad and interconnected areas. In her early research, she focused on the issue of post-Holocaust consciousness and its ethical and psychological ramifications, studying, in her first 2 books, the work of 2 prominent Canadian Jewish writers, the novelist Mordecai Richler and the poet A.M. Klein. Another area of research has been in the field of repressed narratives and stories of Israeli Arabs. In her 4th book, The Freedom to Write, The Woman Artist and the World in Ruth Almog's Fiction, Professor Brenner examines the work of a prominent contemporary Israeli novelist. This volume, a pioneering and persuasive study, in the words of one reviewer, explores the problem of ethical behavior in a post-Holocaust world and argues that the artist has an ethical responsibility to write even when their art is incapable of changing the moral situation of their world. The study of post-Holocaust responses in North America and Israel directed Professor Brenner to the exploration of the responses of the victims in the real time of their victimization. Her book, Writing as Resistance, focuses on the personal writings of 4 Jewish women, Edith Stein, Simone Weil, Anne Frank, and Eddie Hillesum, and their direct ethical responses to the Holocaust. As an example of her scholarly impact, I would like to highlight Professor Brenner's most recent book, The Ethics of Witnessing, The Holocaust in Polish Writers' Diaries from Warsaw, published in 2014. In this study, Professor Brenner examines the ethical dilemma faced by non-Jewish Polish writers in the face of Nazi occupation. Through an analysis of their wartime diaries as well as their literary works, she probes their capacity for an ethical, empathic response to their observation of oppression, cruelty, and murder. Professor Brenner's analysis breaks new ground and has implications of universal importance for the ethical values of humanism in close proximity to the horrors of genocide. A reviewer of the manuscript wrote, "This is the most interesting and challenging study, which sheds important new light on what are among the most difficult moral and human problems of the Second World War, the role of the bystander in the origins of altruistic behavior." The originality and value of this project has already been recognized in the U.S. and in Israel and in Poland. In 2013, a symposium on the manuscript was held at a conference in the prestigious Warsaw School of Social Sciences and Humanities, and Professor Brenner delivered a public lecture sponsored by the U.S. Embassy at the Museum of the History of Polish Jews. And in 2014, she was invited to discuss her book at the Library of Congress. In her teaching, Professor Brenner is a sought-after instructor who maintains relationships with her students long after their graduation. She is exacting and demanding in the classroom, setting high standards for her students as much as for herself. She has taught courses, large and small, on Zionism, the representations of women in modern Jewish literature, and the form of Holocaust themes in the second generation of Israeli writers. These courses are always informed by her research, and so students are brought directly into the scholarly world of modern Jewish writers and Holocaust studies. While Professor Brenner's scholarly trajectory has been outstanding, so are her qualities of loyalty to her college and university, her supportive collaboration with her colleagues, and her dedication to and her concern for our students and their future. It is my honor to introduce her as this year's recipient of the Hilldale Award in the Arts and Humanities.
Thank you, Jeff, for this wonderful introduction. I appreciate it very much. This is the time for thanks, and there are many. As a Hilldale awardee in arts and humanities, I would like to start by expressing my gratitude for having had the privilege to teach humanities in this university. In this time of growing skepticism about the usefulness of the humanities to the future careers and adult lives of our students, I wish to reaffirm my steadfast conviction that teaching humanities is not merely useful. It is indispensable to the process of getting our students ready for their future as successful professionals and contributing citizens. Rather than talking in the abstract, I would like to use this moment to give you an example or two from the field, so to speak. In my course on Zionism and the religious conflicts in the Middle East, I have my class study the historical and theological roots of the present situation in that complicated part of the world. The interest and curiosity my students show in view of the new knowledge reflects growth and engagement. They are being given the tools to understand the world that surrounds them and their place in that world as citizens of the United States. Self-awareness of being accountable for decisions and actions as members of society is crucial to the future success of our students. The concept of responsibility and ethical conduct that we explore in the course on the Holocaust makes students conscious of the moral vulnerability of every human being, including their own. Indeed, in their final essay, the young women and men in my class, who all know or think they know what they want to be in the future, will be using their new knowledge about the importance of moral behavior to explore the ethical aspect of their future careers. In their working lives as physicians, scientists, investors, developers, bankers, and yes, teachers, what ethical principles will guide them at all times? What moral pitfalls behooves them to avoid at all cost? No career is safe or meaningful unless its moral foundations are fully understood and accounted for. And so I feel privileged to be engaged in the humanities as teacher and scholar, and am profoundly honored by the recognition of my work that the award signifies. On this occasion, I remember my original home, the Department of Hebrew and Semitic Studies, which sadly does not exist anymore, and thank my new home, the Center of Jewish Studies, for the warm welcome. My special thank goes to Simon Schreiber and to Mike Bernard Donalds for their support at all times, and who nominated me for this award. Over the years, the graduate school provided me financial support, which allowed me to conduct my research, and the senior fellowship at the Institute for Research in the Humanities gave me the time necessary to complete an important part of my scholarly investigation. I am deeply grateful to both, and I would be remiss not to acknowledge the incredible Van Hise computer support staff who has helped me navigate the innumerable technological transformations over the years. Finally, I would like to thank my children for their loyalty, patience, and love at all times. Shelley couldn't be here. As a social worker, she's taking care of her clients, but Guy could make it. Guy is an alumnus of this university and a triple major in the humanities, whose career defies the dire predictions about the usefulness of liberal arts. Thank you, Guy, for being here, and thank you all for your attention in this award.
Professor Dan Schaefer, Chair of the Department of Animal Sciences, will present Professor Daniel Gianola, recipient of the Hilldale Award in the Biological Sciences. He will accept the award on behalf of Professor Gianola, who is on research leave in Uruguay.
Daniel Gianola is the Sewell Wright Professor of Animal Breeding and Genetics. He earned his B.S. from the Universidad de la República in Uruguay, his native country, and his M.S. and Ph.D. degrees here at UW-Madison in the Department of Dairy Science. In the 1980s, Daniel Gianola was recognized as the world's authority on estimation of animal genetic values for categorical or discrete traits such as fertility, resistance to diseases, and survival. He developed new methodology for dealing with discrete traits that is now in use in many national genetic improvement programs. Over the past 30 years, Dr. Gianola single-handedly brought Bayesian statistical methods to the field of animal breeding and genetics with indirect impacts in evolutionary and human genetics. He showed in the early 1980s that these methods could improve accuracy of estimation of genetic values over current methods, and that the Bayesian formalism could be used to tackle what seemed to be unsolvable problems in statistical genetics, such as accounting for biases due to selective mating of animals. He gained many converts to the Bayesian approach, and today much of the sophisticated research in population quantitative and molecular genetics is done within a Bayesian framework. Since 1982, Professor Gianola has taught over 4,000 international scholars in more than 120 international courses in 25 nations. In 2006, Gianola introduced nonparametric methods for use of quantitative traits and massive numbers of molecular markers in modern genome-enhanced selection methods. These methods are beginning to be applied in animal and plant breeding. His paper was the first in the world proposing the use of these approaches from a quantitative genetics perspective. At UW-Madison, Gianola teaches advanced courses in linear models and Bayesian and machine learning methods. Gianola holds honorary degrees from 6 academic institutions and has been a visiting professor in 13 countries. He has published more than 280 peer-reviewed papers, 3 books, given close to 300 research presentations throughout the world, and trained more than 90 graduate students and postdoctoral researchers, and won numerous national and international awards. He is a recognized pioneer and leader in the science of animal breeding, and we are proud to call him our colleague. Daniel regrets his absence from today's recognition. Prior to receiving notification of this honor, he accepted induction into the Agricultural Sciences Academy of Italy, which takes place this week in Florence. However, he has provided an acceptance message which follows, and I quote him: "It is with gratitude that I accept the 2014-15 Hilldale Award in the Biological Sciences. Regrettably, I cannot be physically present during the ceremony, as I am in Uruguay, making use of a research leave, and then an insurmountable professional conflict has surfaced. I will be traveling to Italy from Montevideo, given previous commitments. I've asked the Chair of Animal Sciences and my colleague and friend, Professor Dave Thomas, to be present and to accept on my behalf this important and meaningful recognition of achievements during my career at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm thankful to them for doing so. I would like to thank the faculty of this stellar university for this recognition, as well as my main department, Animal Sciences, for the support and encouragement I have received since I returned to Madison in 1991. Whatever I have accomplished is largely a function of the superb persons I have associated with, professionally and personally. First and foremost, I wish to acknowledge the contributions made by my graduate students and postdoctoral fellows, the real ground troops of my program. Secondly, I must mention the past and present splendid friends I have in our animal breeding and genetics group in Madison, especially Dave Thomas, whose presence is a source of joy to all of us. Thirdly, the fabulous colleagues and friends in my field from all over the world, I have learned so much from them. I would like to highlight the enormous influence that the late professors Arthur B. Chapman from Animal Science and Genetics at Madison, James F. Crow from the Department of Genetics, and Charles R. Henderson from Cornell University had on my career. They were splendid role models, and I dedicate this award to them. Most of what I do is largely dependent upon the extraordinary support I receive daily from my wife, Graciela, so a big thank you goes to her as well. This award provides a stimulus for continuing my work as a scholar. At 68, this perhaps suggests optimism. However, given that Chapman, Crow, and Sewell Wright lived and worked here until their mid-90s, then why not? Finally, Graciela and I did watch the Wisconsin-Kentucky game from Uruguay. And we will do the same tonight. Go Badgers. Thank you.
Next, Professor Mark Ettinger from the Department of Chemistry will present Professor James L. Skinner, recipient of the Hilldale Award in the Physical Sciences.
I'm pleased to introduce Professor James Skinner as the recipient of the Hilldale Award in the Physical Sciences. Jim received his BS from UC Santa Cruz, his PhD from Harvard, and achieved tenure at Columbia. We were fortunate to have attracted him to UW-Madison in 1989 as director of the Theoretical Chemistry Institute. Jim is one of the leading theoretical chemists in the world. He's a member of the National Academy of Sciences. He has over 200 research publications and has presented over 300 invited talks. He's received a number of prestigious national awards, including the Irving Langmuir Award in Chemical Physics, presented by the American Chemical Society. Jim is a scholar whose work sets him apart as one of the leaders in physical chemistry today. A hallmark of his work is the ability to construct a sophisticated theory that connects to state-of-the-art experiments. His theoretical work not only describes experiments, but provides physical insight that explains the experiments and inspires future work. His intellectual rigor and honesty have impressed everyone who has ever had a scientific conversation with him. I understand that this audience may not be interested in all the technical details of Jim's work, but I want to try to describe some of the beauty of his most recent papers on water. You might think that water, as the most common liquid on the planet, would be thoroughly understood by this time. But in fact, the properties of raw water and its role in biological processes are currently among the most important and exciting topics in chemistry. In a nutshell, proton exchange and bonding between water molecules and the spectroscopy that probes these phenomena are intrinsically quantum mechanical. And while we can precisely describe the behavior of a few isolated water molecules with quantum mechanics, computational resources are inadequate to describe large systems, such as a biological membrane, at this level. In a brilliant series of papers, Jim starts with a sophisticated quantum mechanical description for gas phase water, and then systematically works towards a classical force field that captures many critical aspects of water structure and dynamics. And this can be used with large systems, and it can also accurately describe the spectroscopy of these systems. Powerful new experimental techniques, such as multi-dimensional ultra-fast spectroscopy, can generate a wealth of data about water in various environments, but the interpretation of these data often hinges upon calculations based upon Jim's work. Jim is a committed educator and one of the best teachers in the university. He's a great communicator. He engages students and inspires them to mastery of the material. In evaluating his courses, there have been several occasions, spanning graduate to freshman level courses, when every student in the class has rated him with the top ranking on a 5-point numerical scale. For his teaching excellence, Jim has been awarded the Chancellor's Distinguished Teaching Award, the highest teaching honor of our university. Over the last 30 years, he has mentored more than 40 graduate students and postdocs, and many of these are now active scientists at research universities, national labs, and liberal arts institutions. I know that the success of his former students means a great deal to Jim. Jim's service to the university has been exemplary in other coordinates as well. He has been director of the Theoretical Chemistry Institute since 1990 and organized the Hirschfelder Prize, which is the major international award in theoretical chemistry. He chaired the chemistry department with skill and sensitivity from 2004 to 2007. While chair, he organized a series of listening meetings where he met with groups of students, faculty, and staff to find out how the department could be improved. His willingness to listen to everyone and then to work towards improvement contributes a great deal to our departmental community. Professor Jim Skinner is an exceptional teacher, scholar, and leader, and I'm pleased to introduce him as the recipient of the Hildell Award in the Physical Sciences.
Well, as Mark indicated, I started my career at Columbia University in 1981, and then I came to Wisconsin in 1990. And one of the reasons for the move was that I wanted to be at a public university. And indeed, it's been an honor to be here at one of the great public institutions for 25 years. It's also been a privilege to be in one of the best chemistry departments in the world. Our standards for scholarship and research are impeccable, and the environment of collegiality and support is unparalleled. Especially in my first 10 years at UW, I received excellent mentoring, for which I am forever grateful, from my senior colleagues Hsiuk Yu and Fleming Krim. I'd like to thank my terrific research group for implementing and, in many cases, driving the research we have performed. I'd also like to thank my colleagues in the Theoretical Chemistry Institute for collaboration and community. I would like to thank Arun Yethraj and Bob McMahon for nominating me for this award. And I thank Mark, my physical chemistry colleague, for that beautiful presentation. Finally, I thank my wife, Wendy, for constant love and support over my entire career. And I thank you again for this significant honor.
Professor Judy Halk, Chair of the Department of Gender and Women's Studies, and Professor Jess Gilbert, Chair of the Department of Community and Environmental Sociology, will present Professor Jane L. Collins, the recipient of the Hildell Award in the Social, I always want to say Social Sciences, but it's Social Studies.
Jane Collins is an economic and cultural sociologist. The hallmark of Jane's work is the way she contextualizes ethnographic data, historical events and experiences, and locating them within global political economy. Her books and articles offer fascinating case material, real social conditions, and lived experience, as one reviewer observes. At the same time, her work offers profound analyses of big questions about the effects of globalization on workers and local communities. Jane currently holds a joint appointment in community and environmental sociology and gender and women's studies. I'm just going to mention a sampling. I've got half of the time as the other presenters. So I'm going to just mention a sampling of her work. Jane's approach to the study of labor process places the daily experience of workers in the context of market and political forces. She studies how competitive processes, as well as regulatory regimes and social policies, reshape working conditions. Her first book, published by Princeton University Press, was entitled Unseasonal Migration: The Effects of Rural Labor Scarcity in Peru. In the late 1990s, Jane began a path-breaking study of the global apparel industry that challenged conventional wisdom about how firms engaged in global outsourcing. This work culminated in several articles, as well as her award-winning book, Threads: Gender, Labor, and Power in the Global Apparel Industry, published by University of Chicago Press. Her most recent work in this line, Both Hands Tied, Judy will say a word about. In much of her work, especially since the 1990s, Jane has used a particular and has developed a particular approach or method called commodity chain analysis as a way to understand certain types of global economic conditions. It combines economic study of the commodity chain with ethnographic investigation. More than two dozen dissertations have used her approach by students in her graduate course on commodity chain analysis. Another area of Jane's contribution is global cultural studies. Her work with a colleague entitled Reading National Geographic studies the way that Americans in particular have learned about other cultures. This book has sold over 30,000 copies. That's the sampling. Let me just say a word. I mentioned her graduate seminar and the tremendous influence it's had on graduate students here and the discipline. For the university here in terms of service, she's done an extraordinary amount, serving on most of the major committees and being affiliated with major other units on campus. I'm just not going to take the time to identify. But Jane has also brought her academic expertise to bear in her service on the campus's labor licensing committee from 1999 to 2013, contributing to the effort to make UW a leader in ethical purchasing as a way to improve labor relations in the apparel industry. She's also served as president of the oldest and largest section of the American Anthropological Association and as president of the Association for Feminist Anthropology. One reviewer says that she is a model public intellectual who took her expertise on the apparel industry beyond the pages of books and journals as an activist against sweatshops. Jane truly excels in not only research, as I've indicated here very briefly, and teaching, but also, and especially mentoring, but also public and professional service. And I just want to thank Daniel Kleinman, as well as Judy Houck, in working on the nomination letter. So, Judy.
I'm so delighted that I get to join with Jess in presenting Professor Jane Collins to you. So throughout her work on global labor processes, commodity chains, and economic value, Professor Collins pays particular attention to the circumstances of women as they work on farms, as they labored in textile factories, as they scrambled to meet the economic and emotional needs of their families. As an example, let me introduce her 2010 University of Chicago Press book, Both Hands Tied, Welfare Reform and the Race to the Bottom in the Global Labor Market. At the heart of Both Hands Tied are detailed accounts of women's work and family histories, analyzed in the context of labor market shifts, including levels of unemployment, the decline of manufacturing, and the growth of the service sector in southeastern Wisconsin. These histories vividly illustrate the challenges single mothers face in jobs without sick leave and health insurance. Professor Collins' scholarship shows us how social services from the state were essential to these women's labor market participation, but they often fell short, forcing them back onto welfare when they or their children became ill. The title of the book, Both Hands Tied, captures a central dilemma in the lives of many women. As Professor Collins herself puts it, a failure on the part of both the state and employers to address the new realities of family care prevents women from parenting as they feel they should, on the one hand, and gaining the economic security that has traditionally accompanied full-time work, on the other. In addition to being a first-rate scholar, Professor Collins is also an excellent and sought-after undergraduate and graduate instructor and graduate advisor. Her qualitative research methods in sociology was for many years a cornerstone of the sociology graduate program, and her work teaching the Capstone Seminar in Gender and Women's Studies allowed students in an interdisciplinary major to synthesize their undergraduate experience. Her other courses for Gender and Women's Studies focus students' attention on women's roles as laborers and their place in the global marketplace, unlike any other offerings that we have. Finally, we would like to highlight Professor Collins' leadership on campus. Most notably, she has served on the Social Sciences Divisional Committee, the Graduate School Research Committee, and the University Academic Planning Council. And she has also led the Department of Gender and Women's Studies twice, steering the department through a series of transformations, including its attainment of departmental status and the series and the development approval of its graduate programs. For all of this and more, we are thrilled that she has been honored with the Hilldale Award. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jess and Judy. And thank you to our provost and to the divisional committee. And I just want to know, who is that young person up there? It's kind of startling to see a picture from 10 years ago. I want to express my gratitude to my two departments, to Community and Environmental Sociology and Gender and Women's Studies, for nominating me and for being the two best imaginable places to work. I am so incredibly grateful for the support and the mentorship and the collegiality and the friendship that both units have provided to me over the years. And I also, like Rachel, want to thank the graduate school for the support that they've provided in a number of forms. When I came to UW 23 years ago, having just received tenure at the State University of New York at Binghamton, I guess I didn't know that I would be spending the rest of my adult life here. But Madison has proved to be such an incredibly rich environment for scholarship and for teaching, to help my scholarship and teaching develop, so full of opportunities for collaboration and full of challenges to improve my work. I just want to mention that one of the things that I have appreciated the most have been the opportunities for interdisciplinary collaboration through the area studies programs and the Nelson Institute and the Institute for Research on Poverty. This has really served to widen my vision. Another aspect of UW-Madison that I've come to value greatly is the Wisconsin idea. While in many parts of academia, theoretical work or basic science are seen as being separate from the real world, I appreciate the fact that here at UW we're encouraged to make our work relevant. And I was going to give an example, which actually Jess has already given, of how when I was studying the global apparel industry, I was able to use what I was learning to help develop and implement a code of conduct for our own campus with regard to suppliers of licensed apparel. The challenge to make our work matter for the rest of the world has really been just at the heart of what I value about the experience here at UW-Madison. So thank you again to all who were involved in this award and whose support made it possible.
Please join me in congratulating these distinguished members of our faculty. Let's give them all another round of applause. We have a number of announcements. One is that I was supposed to announce that our faculty elections, and do we have a slide to show? Okay. And this shows you the departments with, yes. Okay. And there is a link, one thing that is not, that does not say up here, but we have a link about faculty elections, which that link there is actually not working right now.
It works for some people, it doesn't work for others.
Right, well, so we're there are some technical glitches, but we're working on it. We hope soon it will be accessible to all. And so we urge you to vote. Elections only work if people vote. So please, this is a participatory democracy, and we need your vote. We also wanted to bring to your attention the updated strategic framework for the university, and I hope you got copies of it. This is just a little overview. When you came in, a lot of you gave feedback on the updating of the framework that had been the framework that officially concluded at the end of 2014. And we went, Maury Cotter and I and the Chancellor, we went and spoke with various constituent groups and got lots of input from lots of people, and it was very helpful. You'll see, for those of you who remember the 2009 document, which the overview, the basic goals and the mission of the university remain the same, because we actually thought it was a great mission, and the goals were very laudable, and we still want to recruit and retain the best faculty and so on and so forth. So, but the updating is just to reflect, you know, new things that have been happening and new ways forward. We also wanted to draw your attention to the handout about the new HR system. This is important because those of you who are, particularly those of you who are chairs, but actually anybody who oversees any other staff member needs to be really know about the new HR system, because one part of the new HR system is that we will actually give people regular feedback on their performance. And so we all need to be involved in knowing how and when we do that. Some of you already do it on a regular basis, but we encourage you, there's a brown bag that you can go to learn more. And if you're not available to go to that, there are other ways we can give you further information. There's also, I believe, was there a prof's update distributed at the door? Did people get that? I didn't see that one. Okay, good. And then, you know, the Chancellor did want, if she had been here, she wanted to mention a few things, and I won't keep you long because I know there are lots of other exciting things people want to do tonight, but, you know, she had been feeling that in every meeting all we were talking about all year long had been the budget, which of course is a big issue, and the budget's important. But the message she and I want to convey to you is that UW is thriving. Like all big public institutions, we have our challenges. But we're not alone, and we've had challenges before, and we've gotten through them. And and continued a tradition of educational and research excellence. And we really think that that will continue. And if you, if you follow the national press about our university, of course, there has been some wonderful national press recently about our basketball team, but it's not just about our basketball team. You know, there looks like there's finally a promising vaccine for Ebola. Where's that research been done? UW-Madison. Where did it come out? It came out in the Journal of Science, but it was picked up in the national and international press. UW oncologists are testing machine they call a game changer in the treatment of cancer. Sort of ViewRay is an MRI for body parts that move like the lungs, and it gives physicians a much better shot at targeting tumors. There are only three of these machines in the world, and our cancer center has been selected as a test site, and it speaks to the quality of our extraordinary cancer research and treatment programs. And there are endless examples like that, whether it's, that we're top five in the nation for the number of faculty who get Fulbright fellowships to do work and research all around the world. In education, we've become a hot ticket with over 33,000 applications, with students applying from 5,700 high schools all around this world, from all 50 states, 102 different countries. And nearly half of the students we have admitted have an ACT of 31 or higher, and almost over 60% of them have a GPA of 3.9 or higher. Now, in my day, it was not possible to have a GPA of higher than 4, but with these new systems with AP and so on, you can actually have a higher GPA than 4, but still 3.9 is not a bad GPA. And we our application numbers are up over last year, where they were up from the year, by over 8% at a time when demographically that's not true, and certainly it's not true in the state of Wisconsin that the number of high school graduates is up by 8%. It isn't. If anything, it's flat or going down. And we have a record number of applications from underrepresented students, and students of color it looks like this next class will have the highest percentage of students of color ever before in the university's history. That is, we hope that people will accept our offers. Of course, we don't know that yet, but and you've probably also heard about, we have two faculty members who won the Sloan Fellowships, and within the same month, two of our faculty in engineering were elected to the National Academy of Engineering. And in outreach, there's all kinds of great things. I encourage you to go to not only watch the basketball game tonight, but also go to our wonderful Wisconsin Film Festival that brings people together from all over the state with 150 films in 8 days. And this now, for the first time, we have a wonderful new edition, a children's film festival. And in addition to having a great basketball team, we've had a lot of wonderful news in sports. That kind of news administrators like things. For example, we were officially the thriftiest recruiter in Big Ten football, according to USA Today. What do they mean by that? That means we're spending less on recruiting each student, but we're also getting the best bang for our buck. An ESPN and New York Times analysis of college football performance relative to the quality of their recruits found that our football program was number one on the overachievement scale, landing 32 points higher than our recruitment prediction based on these students' high school football records. None of this comes as any great surprise to us. The same is true for basketball. In fact, I heard Kaminsky say in a televised interview, well, our team is sort of a team of misfits. We're the guys that other teams didn't want. And in fact, Kaminsky was passed over to be he's from Illinois, to be recruited as a star at Illinois. And I bet they're sorry about that. But anyway. So we do very well, and the academic records of our student athletes are very impressive as well. Now, the budget debate, I can't really give you much of an update because nothing is decided yet. It won't really be, the UW budget won't really come up again until mid-May when the Finance Committee begins to really make some of their tough decisions. Many legislators in both parties have expressed an interest in reducing the size of the budget cut that's been proposed. So that's good news. not sure how much less it will be, and also not sure exactly where they'd get that money. But I jokingly tell people, go out and spend as much money as you can this quarter, because, you know, if revenues are up, they may spend a little more. There are other, of course, there are other constituent groups, other stakeholders who will be at the table also arguing for more money, all of them worthy causes, like K through 12 education. And so we will just have to see. What does seem, what is, for those of you who follow the local press, it does seem like the notion of public authority doesn't seem to have the traction it did a little while ago, at least that's what we're hearing. It seems that both there's some on in both party who are opposed to public authority, but we don't really know. But I do want you to know that no matter what happens, we're moving forward. The regions have moved forward with committees that will focus on shared governance and tenure, because if we did become a public authority and it wasn't everything about the university wasn't in state statutes any longer, then we have to sort of have our own statutes about how the importance of these issues. And the board, the regents are very supportive of these. And one of the points the chancellor makes, and this is absolutely true, that it's actually really unusual to have so much about the state universities explicitly laid out in state statutes. I've been, with the exception of my stint at Northwestern, only at public universities, including for my PhD, and none of them had things like tenure and shared governance in state statutes, but they did have tenure and shared governance. So I think even if there were to be a public authority, I think we can be, I'm on the committee, I don't know if this will reassure you or not, but the tenure committee and the chancellor's in the committee about shared governance, the regents committee. So we will carry the torches for both of those issues. We will work hard to define and protect these principles that are so important to us. We are still hoping that even if the public authority doesn't come to be, that we'll get some of those flexibilities that we've talked about before, including flexibilities like how we get permission to build buildings. Right now, we have to go through the state process for building approvals and everything, even if the building is being completely built with gift money, for example. It still has to go through the whole state building approval process. We cannot raise bonds to build buildings. Most other public universities have bonding authority. So if there were things like that, or for procurement of particularly pieces of scientific equipment, not having to go through the state procurement process, if they could give us a few of those little flexibilities, those could be really helpful to us, and we'll just have to see. You will be hearing, you probably have heard, that later this week the regents will be looking at a proposal from our campus to increase out-of-state undergraduate tuition, and also to increase tuition in some of our professional schools. Those are on the agenda. We're hopeful, not that I love raising tuition, don't get me wrong, but these are important, both important sources of revenue, and also we literally, we're just way behind our peers and actually way below cost in terms of what it costs to deliver, say, a degree in veterinary medicine. What we charge is much lower than our peers charge, and we just can't afford to do it any longer. So we're hoping, and given our popularity with out-of-state students, given that we're the cheapest out-of-state other than Nebraska in the Big Ten, I paid more than almost twice what students paid to come here to send my daughter to University of Michigan. I know that people will pay it because it's a great university, and we will continue to work hard on raising money for financial aid and so on to make sure that we're not just taking wealthier students from out of state, so I want people to really understand that. But those proposals are important to us and important for our ability to balance our budget, so we have our fingers crossed on both of those. I don't want to keep you forever because I know there are a lot of other things that that are important to you, but I do want you to know that there will be some job eliminations in the budget cuts. By job eliminations, often this will be not filling open positions. Now, that takes a toll on departments and units because we often need those positions. It may not be as immediately painful as a layoff, but it does have an impact. And there probably will be some layoffs. There will be some programs that are downsized and merged. And I know that will be hard, and we'll do everything we can to protect our academic and research and outreach missions. So what else do I have to tell you? I think that's about my update. And now, any questions for me before we move on to some of our other agenda items?
Brett Pesor, Genetics. I just wanted to ask about the recent comments about the UW from the UW system president about how adjustments to tenure may be necessary. Does everyone know what I'm talking about? Yeah. So I'm wondering if the committee that you're on,
post tenure review.
Yeah. Do we have?
Well, technically, we already have post tenure review. And so with the UC, I mean, we have talked about that all he's suggesting, not that we would do away with tenure or anything, but just that we would show that we are on after, it's not as if after you're tenured, no one ever looks at your annual report or does a sort of rigorous analysis of, you know, is this person research active and how is their teaching and so on. And we already have a process, so we're going to, the UC is talking about charging a committee to really look at what we do in terms of post-tenure review. I think those of us who believe strongly in the value of tenure also believe that it doesn't mean if you get tenure that you don't have to teach. You can just say, no, I'm not teaching, and I'm no longer research active, and I'm not doing any service, and just forget it, nah. You know, that's not a defensible position for us. So we need to be able to say, no, our faculty really are still very engaged in all the things that they were engaged in when we tenured them. And in like 99% of the time, that's true. So
I mean, of course, I'm all for accountability mm-hmm. for faculty, but I'm just concerned about some of the apparent alignments in the positions of Ray Cross and those in the legislature that are being very critical of the university. And the way in which these discussions are coming up is you know, has to do with tenure. It has to do with faculty governance. That's certainly the way the press is interpreting
mm-hmm,
it.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to make sure that the president of system is representing all faculty at the University of Wisconsin.
I hope so. I know that Ray Cross believes very much in tenure. So, and I'll be on that committee, and we will. I will defend it. But yep.
I'm on the committee.
Oh, and Dorothy is too. She and I and everyone else on that committee, I'm sure, will be.
Do you mind me?
No, jump
so
on.
There are two committees that.
You want the mic? You might need the mic. There's wireless.
Oh, thank you. So there are two committees that. Okay.
You can use to stand up here.
So there are two committees that system has asked for participation and nominations from campuses across the system. One is for looking at tenure, and the other one is for looking at shared governance. We were given, you know, it was one of these quick things, but we were given a few days to put together nominations for those committees. The chancellor is on the committee for Shared governance. Beth Meyerwind here from the university committee is our representative from Madison on shared governance. And then Dorothy Farrar Edwards and Patricia McManus from CALS is on our committee for the other one for tenure. Thank you, gosh. And then Provost Mangelsdorf is on the committee for that on that committee as well. That committee is comprised of lots of different faculty from across campus. I think there is no intention, from system, there is no intention of on our part or anyone else's to get rid of tenure or to get rid of shared governance. One of the things that we have to be very, very careful of is even if we don't go into a public authority in which shared governance and tenure are taken out of state statute, is we have to be very careful about the editing of those state statutes for protections of tenure and shared governance. These kinds of task forces, as well as a post-tenure review ad hoc committee that we're going to be putting together here, are all ways of saying to the state and saying to state government, as well as saying to the system, we value shared governance and we value tenure. And those are our two aspects of the way that we work as faculty. That why would we want to give those up? Why not just close the university if we're not going to have tenure, right? Who's going to stay? So we are very vigilant on protecting both shared governance and tenure process.
Any other questions or comments? If not, we should move to the, are there any additions or corrections to the minutes of our March 2nd meeting? That was quite an interesting meeting. I hope you remember it. If there are none, then the minutes are approved as distributed. Next on the agenda, I'd like to recognize Professor Scott Lutz, who will submit for informational purposes the annual report of the Kemper Knapp Bequest Committee.
Hi, my purpose today is to give you a quick overview of the Kemper Knapp Bequest Committee's work in the last two funding cycles. We have a request for proposals in the fall of the year and make our recommendations for what's to be funded by December of that year. In the past two funding cycles, we funded 22 different requests using 96 to 99% of the money available to us. When reviewing these requests, the committee keeps in mind the spirit from the will of Kemper Knapp, best exemplified by the following quote. In general, it is my wish that such funds be used for purposes outside the regular curriculum of the university, to cultivate in the student body ideals of honesty, sincerity, earnestness, tolerance, and social and political obligations. As in the past, the majority of the money from the fund is used to encourage scholarship. Scholarship has been granted toward undergraduate and law scholarships, minority scholarships administered through the Office of the Chancellor, and the graduate school fellowships. The committee also makes regular allotments to the to the Lectures Committee and to the Morgridge Center for Public Service. Additionally, we review one-time grants on the order of $500 to $5,000 in each of the funding cycles, and we've provided a more detailed accounting of the work we've funded for the past two funding cycles available in your curriculum. Thank you.
Next, I would like to recognize Professor Elizabeth Larson, who will submit for informational purposes the annual report of the University Lectures Committee. Elizabeth?
You have the faculty document 2555. It's the 2013-2014 Lectures Committee report. I only want to highlight two things for you. One thing I want to talk about today, just so you have it's an initiative we're working on called the GO Initiative, Green and Open Lectures. We're trying to move a bit from the stand and deliver kind of lectures to lectures that will reduce the carbon footprint by bringing people in at a distance. So instead of funding travel, we can fund the use of technology to bring somebody to campus. So we're looking into ways to do that. And also we're looking at ways of making them more open to people. By open, we mean accessible to all. And our first initiative in that regard is to look at how to do live captioning and how to provide that. So we're going to pilot live captioning and add a funding line for that. So if you want to make it accessible to a greater audience, for it's the curb cut of lectures in a way, makes it accessible to everybody. So we're looking to pilot that in the fall and see how that goes, because we know that will slightly reduce what we can give as far as the amount of lectures we can fund, but we also think it's pretty important for making it more accessible to the general audience. And the other part of that we're trying to do is look into creating a searchable archive. Right now, these lectures are delivered and then they disappear unless, of course, they're put on a website somewhere. So we're looking at ways we maybe can create a searchable database so that the community and beyond the community here on campus can actually have access to these scholars who we're inviting from around the world. Okay. The other thing I want to point out is there's an underutilization of the William K. Fitch funds. In fact, we had nobody apply this year, and those funds continue to accrue. Those funds are made for inviting prominent business people to give lectures on the American Free Enterprise System. So if anyone would please submit lectures that fit that criteria, we would really love that, because we'd like to utilize that fund. And I want to thank the committee, because they've done a lot of work. They review 70 lectures a year on a monthly basis. We have a number to review, and their work and their willingness to take on these initiatives was a new demand that we made on them. So any questions? Okay, thanks.
We need to encourage people to think of creative ways to put forth some applications for the fund that's underutilized. We don't want any funds that are just accruing dollars. That need not be someone who writes in support of the American Free Enterprises. I mean, it could be someone who's critical of the American. So just think broadly. Leave no endowment fund unused, particularly in these days. I'd next like to recognize Professor Murray Clayton, who will submit for informational purposes the report of the Ad Hoc Committee on Boycotts and Academic Freedom.
The committee report has been distributed to you, and rather than reading through the whole thing, I'll just highlight a few points. The committee focuses specifically on academic boycotts, that is to say, boycotts whereby the UW-Madison faculty withdraw from cooperation with other academic institutions. In formulating our recommendations, we start from the point of view of FPP 8.01A, which emphasizes the principles of academic freedom. And we believe that these rights are very important. And so we believe that the risk of curtailing academic freedom dictates that boycotts by UW-Madison faculty should be rare. That is not to say that we should never have a boycott, but rather that we should weigh the importance of academic freedom and consider boycotts in that light. We note, of course, that the same rights that are mentioned in FPMP 801A, that is to say, the rights that come to you by virtue of the constitutions of the U.S. and state of Wisconsin, that guarantee that each individual has the right to act on their own to boycott an entity if they so choose. In our recommendations, we provide a series of questions which we hope will guide anyone who's considering a boycott, and that might be an individual person making a motion, or the university committee, or the faculty senate. That's it in a nutshell. If there are questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
I believe that is all of our business for today. So we're adjourned for today, but go Badgers, on Wisconsin.